Japanese community was the first one that came to show support after 9/11 for the American Muslims and South Asians. They have been through the same thing.
Put on your TV right away.
My neighbors and friends said that there's a smoke cloud all over.
We were given an order to evacuate the building immediately.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Jean Cochran. Two planes crashed into the Twin Towers of the World Trade Center in New York this morning, about 20 to 30
minutes. As American symbols of power collapsed into rubble, taking thousands of lives, a fear of homeland insecurity spread across the country. Some turned against people they associated with the terrorists.
The backlash has hit every region of the country. In Chicago, a pro-American demonstration got out of hand when several hundred people converged on an Islamic center and began chanting anti-Muslim slogans. In Seattle, a man was caught pouring gasoline around cars outside the city's largest mosque. In Indiana,
regardless of whether you've been born in the country, you don't speak with an accent, you feel as American as anyone else around you, they see you as belonging to a larger group of people whom they don't feel belong in the country.
Deepa Iyer with South Asian American Leaders of Tomorrow is speaking about the targeting of Muslims and South Asians after the 9/11 attacks. But this is not the first time a community has been singled out during a national crisis.
On December 7th, 1941, Japan, like its infamous Axis partners, struck first and declared war afterwards.
Japan's attack on Pearl Harbor brought the United States into World War II. The bombing also launched an internal attack on Americans of Japanese descent, particularly on the West Coast.
Three tall white men came knocking on our door, and they just all showed a little card, and it said, Federal Bureau of Investigation.
Yuri Kochiyama taught Sunday school in San Pedro, California, on the morning of the bombing. She returned home to her father, who was recovering from surgery just the day before.
And then they asked if Seishi Nakahara lived there, and I said, oh, yes, that's my father. And he said, where is he? And I said, he's sick. He's in the back sleeping. They just went right in the house, didn't say another word, woke him up and told him, put on your slippers and bathrobe. And everything happened so fast, I didn't have a chance to even ask, where are you taking him? Well, I think every Japanese was calling up each other to say, did they take your father away yet?
This story foreshadows what happened to many families right after September 11th. Hundreds of men from South Asian or Middle Eastern countries were swept up and detained.
My name is Bobby Khan, and I'm interpreting for Malik Ali. I was hearing it from the people, those were regularly going to the mosque, that FBI and INS is cracking down where predominantly Pakistanis and Muslim community is living.
Their men, their fathers or brothers were taken away to detention centers, were interrogated, were investigated, and were denied access to their own family members, were denied access to counsel, were part of the disappeared in America.
In the first 48 hours after the attack on Pearl Harbor, more than 700 Japanese Americans were rounded up. Yuri Kochiyama's family discovered their father was taken to a federal prison on Terminal Island. Despite his poor health, he was being interrogated for hours as a prisoner of war. 6 weeks later, her father returned home in an ambulance and passed away the next day. The family had little time to grieve because on February 19, 1942, President Franklin Roosevelt signed Executive Order 9066. All Japanese Americans living on the West Coast were ordered to inland internment camps.
Two-thirds of the evacuees are American citizens by right of birth. The rest are their Japanese-born parents and grandparents. They are not prisoners. They are not internees. They are merely dislocated people. The unwounded casualties of war.
It was only what you could carry. We just could not carry anything that could be used as a weapon. I mean, no knives. I don't think they let us bring chopsticks. No radio. We knew that bedding's important, so We all carried some beddings, but all these young mothers who had babies, gee, they had all those bottles and diapers and stuff like that to carry that they couldn't bring much besides the baby stuff.
More than 110,000 Japanese Americans were moved to 10 internment camps throughout the United States. Once released at the end of the war, the Iseis, Japanese immigrants, had to rebuild their lives from scratch.
Iseis lost their homes, they lost their work, their income, everything. I mean, self-determination, civil rights, they lost really everything.
When the Japanese were interned, the only group that stood up in protest to their internment were the Quakers.
John Oda is the reverend at Pine United Methodist Church, an historically Japanese-American church in San Francisco.
I have members that talk about members of the local Quaker church providing them with sandwiches for the train ride to the internment camp. It's sad that no one else stood in opposition to this illegal internment. You know, that's one of the reasons why we were very quick and very strong to stand up and to be here.
Right after 9/11, vandals destroyed large glass doors to the Islamic Center of San Francisco. Pine United raised funds to help replace these doors and became a sister church to the mosque. Many Japanese Americans quickly spoke out against a repeat of mass roundups and incarceration after 9/11. But the government did implement another form of racial profiling. The Department of Justice instituted the Special Registration Program in September 2002. Malik Ali first heard about it at his mosque.
Actually,
I was very much afraid when, after the prayer, I heard that some INS official is speaking. They just said that you should come for registration. We will be giving you legal status, whosoever will comply with this program.
But special registration was not amnesty. The program required men 16 years and older from 25 designated countries to present themselves to their local INS office for fingerprinting and interrogation.
I remember community members saying that I want to go, but I'm really afraid of what could happen to me, and I'm not sure whether I should go or whether I should just stay under the radar screen.
When I entered into the Federal Plaza, it took me about 10 hours in the waiting area. It was very crowded and I was not explained what to do. People were saying, we have done a mistake. They were arresting people. And we heard some immigration officers saying, don't worry, stay here and we will give you the legal status. After about 10 hours, some agent took me to the 10th floor for the investigation. And when I was taken there, they asked me to sit on a hard bench. And someone was threatening very loudly, harassing that you should know who you are and you must know why you are here and you better cooperate with us. You belong to such a country where the Muslims are and Muslims are terrorists and stuff. It was very strange for us that we came here voluntarily to comply with the program. And now people are being harassed, being arrested. And on the top, they kept my passport. And I was told that you will not be returned your passport. It will be a judge, immigration judge, who will make a decision about you and he'll put you in the prison.
Definitely, as more and more stories came out about immigrants under this program, going in and then being detained and being deported, this definitely created another wave of fear and increased this weight of feeling that you are constantly being targeted, that you are constantly being profiled.
I had no choice left except to pray that God showed them that we are innocent people and we should not be treated like that. We should not be harassed. We should not be intimidated. We should not be put in the prisons. We should not be deported.
The special registration program wrapped up in April 2003. Nearly 83,000 men voluntarily complied. 13,000 men, including Malik Ali, received deportation orders, primarily for minor visa violations. no one was charged with terrorist activity.
Our next speaker is going to be Yuri Kochiyama.
The reason I felt it was important to speak out right away is because the U.S. has been doing the same thing over and over. First from 1882 when the Chinese Exclusion Act, then they had one law after another, you know, where Japanese could not own land, Asians could not become citizens.
And throughout our country's history, many groups of people have been framed as the other because of their skin color or their last name or their country of origin without looking into their individual culpability.
But in the midst of this backlash from government and individuals, committed alliances have formed. Japanese, Arab, and South Asian Americans, civil rights and immigrant rights activists, Christians, Muslims, and Jews are all standing together.
So I think we just need to stand together, and it is the kind of thing that we need to make the most beautiful, diverse human wall of support and strength for one another.
We are coming forward as a community that has felt the sting of racism and racial profiling, and understanding how the government can snatch your rights away from under your feet, and we will stand in solidarity with them.
We are together. We are going to be one body, trying to protect everyone.